We're taking a look at the effect that women had on our economy and our culture when they started joining the workforce in larger numbers. Hi, Jill Nadeau here. I'm holding down the fort for Larry Mueller. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. In the studio with me is Nan Ensten, and she is a history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of the book Ladies of Labor, Girls of Adventure, Working Women, Popular Culture, and Labor Politics at the Turn of the 20th Century. Did your grandmother or great-grandmother work outside the home? Did she share with you what that experience was like? Well, join our conversation. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post a question, a comment, or a photo on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. Did you have a strong working woman in your life? Share her picture with us. We'd love to see that. Nan, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And I know you're working on a new book. Does it have something to do with women in history also? Or
it does. It's about the history of cigarettes.
Oh, my goodness. That's interesting.
Yes, it's not exclusively about women, but mm-hmm. It definitely women are part of that story.
Oh, sure.
In many ways, as workers and as consumers.
Yeah, so, I'll bet. Well, today we're talking a little bit about women when they first started coming into the workforce and pretty large numbers. Why don't you tell us when that actually was? I'll bet you it's earlier than people are thinking.
Yeah, well, when I ask my students that question in my women's history class, most people think it's World War II.
Right.
You know? And I think that that's a very common and reasonable thing because we have so much attention on that. But in a way, it's kind of a trick question because women have always worked. Women have worked on farms. Women have worked. The home used to be, you know, a productive place where that brought in money. And so women's labor in the home was productive labor that was important for the household economy. They raised chickens, they did sewing. So there's that aspect of kind of destabilizing that question a little bit. And then there's also the fact that when we ask that question, we often are thinking of a certain kind of worker, a certain kind of woman worker. And so the question becomes silly if we are asking that about African-American women workers, for example, who began their work life in this country as their forebears began their work life in this country as slaves. A lot of people, forebears began their working lives as indentured servants in this country. If they have people who came over to this country before the mid-19th century. But in terms of our kind of model of, you know, women in the workforce today, women started entering the workforce in great numbers in the 1890s. So over 100 years ago. And I like to say that the last 100 years of history has shown the most rapid change in women's status and also women's work lives in history.
What was it that caused them to seek out work outside of their home area?
Well, it was really, it was industrialization. There were a lot of immigrants, I bet a lot of listeners have family who came to this country at that time, because that's in Wisconsin, a lot of immigrants came to the United States in the late 19th century. And so they would go work in factories, and those jobs were really fueling the new economy.
And how was that received at home, though? Was that something that was done out of necessity, or were these women just wanting to get out of the house?
Well, it was absolutely done out of necessity. These weren't great jobs. These were really difficult jobs. These were grueling jobs. This was before there were hour laws or very many safety laws in effect. And so women worked out of necessity, but they worked often temporarily. So, for example, what a lot of people don't realize is that there's a big break in about the turn of the middle of the 20th century about who was working. So before, like in the 1890s, the numbers of single women that were working were rising really rapidly. So married women were back in the home because they were taking care of kids, right? And they might be doing productive labor in the home. They might be doing piecework. A lot of women were sewing. You know, a lot of women were working sewing machines in the garment industry in Chicago, in New York City, and around the country. And those jobs were hiring mostly single women.
And we actually have a caller. We've got Julie and Maza Maney. Hi, Julie.
How are you?
I'm well. What's your comment?
Well, your request for grandmothers or great-grandmothers who worked was, it hit a real soft spot in my heart. I am a baby boomer. I am nearly 60 years old, and I have been an entrepreneur for 30 years. And I have to credit both of my grandmothers. They both were born and raised near Richland Center. My father's mother quit high school to marry my grandpa, but she ended up becoming a social worker in Richland County back in the 1930s. And during World War II, she worked at Badger as a social worker counseling the women whose husbands had been sent overseas for the war.
Wow.
And then my other grandmother, when she and my grandpa were divorced, gosh, late 50s, early 60s, took over running the Starlight Motel in Richland Center, and she ran that for years as a female business owner and entrepreneur. So they both set remarkable examples for me.
I'd say. Well, thank you for sharing that with us, Julie. Nan, is that kind of typical?
Well, running the Starlight Hotel, that is typical. And when a woman finds herself without the support of a husband for whatever reason, death, divorce, abandonment, anything like that, then taking over, that goes back to the colonial era, actually. In the colonial era, they called it a woman being a deputy husband.
Deputy husband.
Because those roles were so associated with men that they saw women as kind of stepping in. So that's a really time-honored position, and it is how many of the female entrepreneurs really got their start, is, again, out of necessity, taking on a role that might have been frowned upon otherwise, but because of circumstance, they were able to do that and generally were embraced by communities because of the exceptional circumstances. A little different than if, a woman had started out as a 23-year-old deciding that they wanted to be...
This is what I'm going to do.
Right, an entrepreneur. I'm going to forego the marriage and those kinds of things.
Sure.
So that's more typical. But the social worker, now that was a new job, a brand new job in the 1930s. And women worked their way into this profession because they basically invented it.
Oh, well,
women reformers in the progressive era basically invented social work because they looked around at what was happening in these factories that we were just talking about, and they were seeing all of the problems, the exploitation, and the problems in immigrant communities, and they stepped up and said, we want to do something about this, and we want to help people. And so they started first just volunteering and creating voluntary associations, and they eventually, kept developing that into the profession of social work.
Oh, interesting. Our guest is Nan Enstan. She is a history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she's the author of the book Ladies of Labor, Girls of Adventure. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd love to hear more stories like Julie just shared with us about working women in your life who inspired you. These women are now bringing home a paycheck. How did that affect their sense of freedom and what they could then purchase or become part of that kind of a part in society. How did that, how was that affected?
That's a great question. So it's, there's a mixed answer.
Yeah. Always is, right?
Right?
Always is.
For single women, they were often living with their family of origin. And in these immigrant neighborhoods, they would turn over their paycheck to their mothers, who were usually, in most immigrant families, were the household managers.
Okay.
And they would get a little portion of that back because they were working. So in that sense, they weren't very often just kind of running off with the cash. And another wrinkle in that story is that for married women who were working, their, by law, their earnings belong to their husbands. And so there was a kind of an ethical notion that they deserve to have some access to it. And a husband would maybe be frowned upon for not allowing that. But it was within his rights to control that money.
Okay. So then did that kind of feed into the commercialism that we kind of see now? Is that where it started?
For women having access to a paycheck?
Right. Or? I'm just thinking, you know, there's a little extra money. And, you know, since they're not at home and there are some things that they're going to need, do they start buying clothing rather than making it? Is that how that kind of started?
Yeah. It definitely is. There's, you know, I said that this was the industrial economy that women started going out and working in factories in. Well, that industrial economy was the consumer culture that we are the, you know, we are now in the second century of,
sure.
for good or for ill, right?
Yeah, right. Depends on your opinion.
So working women, for example, my first book is about working women who worked in the garment factories and couldn't often afford to buy the clothes that they were making. But if you sit and you make beautiful clothes all day, you're going to want to buy some beautiful clothes. So they would buy cheap knockoffs in the neighborhood, or they would sew their own. So yeah, I think that there is a dynamic interplay. Even when there wasn't a lot of extra cash, I put the buying, a little bit more buying power into women's hands.
Okay. Well, you know, we've got some callers. I think we have some great stories, I'll bet. Let's go to Catherine in Verona. Hi, Catherine. What story
Hello,
do you have for
you
us?
Hear me? Oh, good morning.
Yes.
Good morning. I wanted to tell you about my grandmother, who started a business of her own. Because I can't remember exactly the date, but she's actually, you could look her up online if you're doing research about women entrepreneurs. She lived in Iowa, and she had the longest running talk radio program, just like this, published out of the upstairs of the Seed House in Shenandoah, Iowa. I think it must have started in the late 20s. They broadcast live every day for 30 minutes to farm women that were at home, probably just having served lunch to their farm husbands and were really isolated out in the country in Iowa. But it went national, and it, because of the unregulation of the broadcasting power back then, the wavelength, you could hear it all over the country, and she would get letters from people all over the country telling her how much they loved the program. She and her sisters would sit and talk about kitchen things. The name of the program was Kitchen Clatter, and they'd talk about what they'd done in their home with their children. My grandmother was named Leanna Field Driftmeyer, and she was the sister of Henry Field, who had the Field Seed Company that's still a catalog item today. But Leanna started this company so that she could help take care of her children and also bring income into the family. They published. They had a line of home products that eventually were sold to grocery stores, like cleaning products and food flavorings and things like that. It's quite amazing.
That is amazing. Well, thank you for sharing us with that. That's almost like Oprah, you know, in Iowa. So was that common for women to have a radio show?
It was actually, and not common, it was always extraordinary, but there was a moment that where this was something that happened, and it came out of the extension movement, really. So the farm extension movement, UW, Iowa, I'm sure, was also very prominent in that, and trying to reach out to farm women, that was kind of a theme of the time, and there were women radio announcers in the 1940s. There are a couple books about it, not enough, but there are are women around the country who were involved in radio production. And that's a fascinating story. I would love to get a student doing research on that.
Oh, we would love to hear it if you get some more information. Our guest is Nan Enstand. She is a history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we've been talking about the cultural influence of women entering the workforce at the turn of the century and after. I'm Jill Najoe. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Stay with us. We'll continue the conversation right after the news. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe. I'm filling in for Larry this week. Our guest is Nan Enstand. She is a professor in the history department of the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of the book Ladies of Labor, Girls of Adventure, Working Women, Popular Culture, and Labor Politics at the Turn of the 20th Century. We're talking about how women entered the workforce starting in the late 1800s and how that affected our culture. Tell us about a woman in your life who is a pioneer in the workforce. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email. That's ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Please share a photo of a working woman who influenced you. And Nan, I think we're going to go right back to the phones because we've had some really nice stories that we've shared with us. And Amy and West Bend, why don't you tell us about your grandmother?
Yes, I will. It's kind of a cute little story. As I'm sitting in my kitchen sewing, I was listening to your stories, and I thought, oh, I've got to call about my maternal grandmother. And she actually was married back in the 30s and had gone through a divorce, lived up in Plover, Wisconsin, which is a very rural area on a farm, had two children at the time of this divorce, my mother being one of them. She moved down to West Dallas area back in the 40s and lived with a relative in one of her rentals. And took it upon herself one day to go knock on the door of a factory, which was called Alice Chalmers.
Just a small factory, right?
Yeah, quite big. It was actually built in around 1902.
Right.
And between 19 and 1930, it grew the population by fivefold. So my story is that I'm just so excited that she actually became the first crane operator for that company as a woman.
That's pretty exciting, Amy. Did she influence you in your career choices?
Well, I'm a gardener, and the way she influenced me, I do personal gardening for people, is when she lived in Milwaukee, when she'd have her spare time, she'd bring us kids down to Milwaukee, and we'd tour through the domes with her and help her with her gardens, and I'm probably only daughters that took on all that, but she won many mayor awards for that. But what I really wanted to say about her is growing up as a child, she lived on a farm, and I think the farm equipment gave her no fear in walking on that door and taking it upon herself to say, I can do this too.
Sure, that makes total sense. Well, thank you for sharing that with us, Amy. Now, Nan, I know like before World War II, women were expected to have certain jobs, but once the war came and the men went off to fight, those jobs opened up, very untraditional. Why don't you talk a little bit about that and how that happened?
Yeah, well, I think it's especially those kinds of jobs in the 1940s that had those were very well paid jobs.
They were.
And because they involved big machinery, they were associated with men. Mm-hmm. Now, and they still are, right?
They still are. I don't know why, but they still are.
Yeah. And it's funny because, I worked at a grounds crew once and the guys would drive those cases, you know?
Sure.
And the women all worked with shovels. And it was like, so those kinds of ideas are still with us in our culture. So it really took an emergency and men going off to war to open up those jobs to women, and those jobs, and as my story just indicates, those jobs closed to women after the war, the big machinery jobs, and
the men came back.
The men came back, and those were now one thing that I think is really interesting about the World War II is that we think of women just going back to the home, but statistically, when we look at it, women didn't actually go. There was like a very temporary return to the home as women lost those jobs, but the actual rate of women working continued to increase after World War II. And so basically what happened is that was the turning point where we started to go into married women working more and having more two income households. Being more of a norm.
And do you think because they got that taste of working outside the home, and some of them, I'm sure, really enjoyed that, that motivated them then once they did get married to go back out?
I think it was still usually necessity. I mean, I think it's interesting that this last caller also had a grandmother who had gone through a divorce.
Sure.
And so I think that we can see that that it's necessity driving it. But yeah, when women went into the workforce, and you can hear the pride in the caller's
sure.
voice, right? You know, men had always known this, that work is something that gives you a sense of identity. It gives you a sense of purpose. If it's a good job, if it's a well-paid job, it gives you a sense of purpose, and it gives you a community in the world. So, yeah.
Great. Well, let's go to Jill in Oshkosh. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I just wanted to let you know that on my mother's side, there is a bunch of women who have, I figure, are fairly strong women. My great-grandmother was a nurse in the Civil War. She followed her husband down south from Wisconsin, and then my grandmother became a teacher before she was married. My mother got her master's in applied chemistry and became a medical technologist so she could finish my dad putting him through dental school, and then I became a software engineer in the 70s, which is not too typical either. So a number of strong women in my family.
Great. Yeah, and actually, there weren't many people doing software engineering in the 70s, period. So, way to go, Jill. What did you have to say about that?
Well, man? I think one of the things, you know, I love these stories because they really show that people know these family legacies, and there's pride in them.
There
right?
is.
There's pride in what women were doing. Mm-hmm. And I guess I want to underline, since we're talking about people's mothers and grandmothers, that these women were also raising children at the same time.
And probably taking care of the house.
And probably taking care of the house. So, and there wasn't the support for that. There still isn't support for that, frankly. So I think that that's just, that's really remarkable.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Let's go to Carlene in Brooklyn. Hi, Carlene. What story do you have?
Hi. I'm thinking about all the influences on my own upbringing. I go back to my paternal great-grandmother who, with her husband, managed a farm and really ended up taking care of my dad and his family. My grandfather was an alcoholic who probably, fortunately, was killed when my dad was about 14, because my grandmother had been very abused before that time, and then she went to work because it was the time when women were going to work in the factories, and this was in Georgia. So she also had the foresight to send her daughters away to school where they, at the Berry Academy, it's in the mountains in the state of Georgia, where people worked their way through. My dad and his brothers also went there. There's an ironic situation where Martha Berry had the foresight to see that poor children were not getting a good education. So she started a school where kids were boarded but also worked their way through. They had a sawmill, a laundry, a farm. And so both my aunts finished high school and then went on to college, as did my father and his brothers. They were the first in their family to go to college. He met my mother, who bucked the family trend in New York City, and went away to college at 22 after she saved enough money for herself to go to college. They married, and my mother quit school, had my brother and I, and when I was in the fourth grade, went back to school, finished her education, and became a teacher. And all this time, my grandmother in Georgia was still working. She was a house mother in a fraternity house, after which is, you know, something that doesn't happen anymore.
Wow. Yeah.
Right. Did that until some of the alumni fraternity brothers said, "Mrs. Brown, this is not a place for you anymore. You need
dear.
To retire." So she retired and took over the the County Meals on Wheels program, and she worked at that until she was 76, and she was killed in a car accident.
Oh.
So my great grandmother died when I was 7 and was still taking in piecework and running the family farm. My mother worked until my brother graduated from college, and when my dad was close to retirement, she also retired.
All right, Carlene. Well, you had some really strong women in your life. Is this kind of a typical thing?
Well, I think it is. I mean, each story is so moving and so powerful. But I think that what is common is that women stepped up and did what they had to do. And that gets lost in sort of our stereotype of women weren't out of the workforce until World War II or until the 1970s even.
Sure.
You know, but that actually women were stepping up and doing what they needed to do to make the family survive. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. And it's kind of family. It is family oriented, isn't it?
Right. And yeah. The dislocation that happens because of death or divorce or abuse was often the motivator, and so we're seeing a real theme come through with that.
And I know Carlene had mentioned about education. How important was the education and the type of jobs that women got into?
Oh, huge. You know, I think that this time we're really seeing the rise in women's education. I mean, in the 19th century, there were, well, even going back into the colonial era, of course, there were women who were agitating for women's education. But the graded school movement really took off in the early 20th century, late 19th century, is when school became something that most people did, regardless of class, at least for a little while. And that made a big difference. So, yeah, that's been a fight all the way through. Why would you need to educate a girl?
Really?
That's a waste of money.
Waste of money. Make sure they can sew and paint and recite poetry. Our guest is Nan Enstad. She is a history professor at the University of Wisconsin, and we're talking about women in the workforce. If you want to join our conversation, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And we're going to go back to the phones right now. We have Chris in Kenosha. You have an interesting question. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And I really appreciate this topic. It's important for everyone to learn about their mothers and grandmothers and their history. And I was on my way over actually to my mother-in-law's house. She's 90 years old. We're doing some things today, and we have a coffee pot on the stove. And she had her, in the 40s and 50s, she had her own band, and actually into the 60s, she had her own accordion band that she named herself Julie's Top Hatters. And she had her own business teaching students. And I'm just impressed at how she would go to these bars with her band and work behind the bar and around all these, you know, people drinking. And for me personally, to be in that environment, I have this stereotype of what I think that would have been like, maybe kind of rough. But she went and did it, booked her own bookings. And I was just curious how common maybe that was, or not common.
Chris, was it an all-women's band, or was
it? No, she was the only woman. She was the lead with the accordion, and she had her own drummer. And
well, Nan, was that common?
Well, she sounds great.
She does. Yeah, what a hoot.
There's a couple different ways that you can plug into kind of a bigger history story, but it was always exceptional. I mean, that's a wonderful, wonderful story. Women started performing. Well, women have always performed. You know, you mentioned painting just
right.
a minute ago.
Mm-hmm.
And well, music is something that women were allowed to do, right?
Right.
You can learn an instrument.
Piano, sure.
Yeah, across the class divide, right? Because middle class, upper class women were encouraged to learn music, but working class women would learn it along with their brothers from family members and things like that. So music is really something that women have always been able to do now, and teaching piano, teaching various things
very
is
true.
A very traditional job for women. Now, performing is less traditional, but of course women have the skills, and so they did go out and perform, and there were particular moments when there were very strong trends of female singers that became very popular. The 20s was one era, the 40s was another era, black and white, becoming very popular, well-known, recorded, listened to around the country and really around the world. And in the 40s, we talked about men leaving their jobs and going to war. Right. Well, men also left their jobs as musicians and went and either served in the army, or they sometimes served in the army band, because there were actually army, you know, military musicians.
And there still are.
And so women's bands became very popular during the 1940s. And you asked if it was an all women's band, and this one was not. But that also, I think, when you think about people looking around at the culture and saying, well, what can I do? You know, what's okay to do? Can I really do that? Well, in the 1940s, there were a lot of examples of fantastic women jazz bands out there to look at. And so I'm really happy to hear that there were also some Wisconsin accordion bands.
I know. I love the fact that she did it for after that, too.
And
she
after,
just
kept doing
going.
It.
That's wonderful, because it isn't an easy job.
Right? I have a neighbor, my next door neighbor. When I moved into this house about a decade ago, she was about to turn 90, and she had her own band too with two other women, and she would still perform sometimes. And what a great garage sale. I got a lot of her costumes. Oh, she's a hoot.
I'll bet. Lucky you. Well, thank you, Chris. We really appreciate you sharing that with us. Let's go to Joan in Milwaukee. You've got a pretty interesting woman in your background too, huh?
Yes, I could tell you my own family story, and in fact, since I'm almost 90, I could tell you the battles I had to continue teaching for 60 years.
Wow! I'll
but
bet.
I must tell you about a dear, dear friend who just celebrated her 102nd birthday. Charlotte Blystone. She is a very unassuming woman, but all of her family were musicians, and her grandfather said she wasn't. She was the only person, and her grandfather said, Charlotte, you become a lawyer, and I'll pay for your education. She did, and she was the first woman on the boards with all of these men, and she was not taken very pleasantly. They were not very happy with that, but she was bright and she had no clients. So she had moved out to Greendale, and she sold insurance. And then she would say, by the way, you know, I am a lawyer. So she got clients, and the insurance company said, hey, you're not doing anything for us. So she left them, but she practiced all of her life until she was, I believe, 98 or 99, when she had a minor auto accident, and she said, I think it's time I quit. So since she couldn't drive anymore, she quit practicing, but she is still active in the United Nations and the Public Enterprise Committee, working for the common good, and she is brighter than all of us. And we said, what do you accredit that to? Well, my diet. When I was 35, I couldn't braid my hair, but my neighbor had a brother who was a scientist doctor, and he checked my blood type with all of the foods, and I found there was one food type I could eat, which I lived by. I gave up coffee, which for me would be horrible, but he said I could braid my hair again. The arthritis went away.
Oh.
And she said it's her diet that has gotten her through.
Okay, well, thank you, Joan, so much for sharing that story. I can't imagine women in law back in the, well, this must have been, what, the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
That must have been difficult.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, that the male lawyers refused to work with her is so telling.
Yes.
That she had to fight her way into getting clients, and that she could get clients that knew her, that were willing to go with her, but the brotherhood wouldn't let her in.
And I bet
very typical. Yeah.
She probably practiced a lot longer than they did too.
right. She outlasted them all. So it shows them. But I think it's also, you know, the caller just mentioned the fight to keep teaching. And I think that's something that hasn't come up yet, which is, you know, my family are all teachers. But there were laws in place that said that women had to quit teaching when they got married. When those laws went away, there still were laws that said you had to, not laws, but rules within school districts that said that you had to quit when you had kids.
So
my grandparents' age, you know, my aunts, great aunts and grandmother had to battle the marriage law, but my mother and her sisters had to battle the law about having kids.
Always something. And, of course, it never pertained to the male teachers.
No, and those laws were perfectly legal until 1964 Civil Rights Act. So we really need to look at that legislation that comes along and changes things really dramatically and suddenly.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we've only got a couple of minutes left before we have to leave this topic, which has been so much fun. But maybe you could kind of share something with us, maybe something that's out of the ordinary story about a woman who, you know, that you know that fought the good fight and won.
I guess one of the more interesting stories that comes to mind is really flight attendants. Their history is a really dramatic one. Because
you mean stewardesses? Air quotes,
right. Yeah. Well, and they were ones who had those kinds of really, when airline travel became really popular, or at least it became possible in the 50s and 60s, it was an era when all of these laws were absolutely constitutional. And we need to remember how recent that really is.
It wasn't very
long
ago. And
they didn't go away automatically at all. Mm-hmm. And so there were rules about being fired when you were 30, because no one over 30 is attractive
Heaven
enough.
Heaven forbid. No.
And laws about weight and appearance and things like that. Rules, I should say.
Yeah.
And stewardesses fought back. Oh. And they really worked their way out of those and had a big impact on work for all women.
Well, Nan, thank you so much for being with us today, and thank you for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guest has been Nan Enstan. She's a history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Coming up on the Kathleen Dunn Show, she's going to be talking with a New Yorker writer about recently profiled a safe house in Buffalo where the asylum seekers from around the world prepared to flee to the U.S. from Canada. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. There's much more to come.